Daniel chapter 2. Does everybody have four pieces of paper? Okay, when we're all done, if you're here for every night and so on, you'll end up with, I think, 63 pieces of paper. So you might want to, I haven't punched these. You might want to punch them and put them in a binder like I've got up here, you know. If my computer ever crashes, I can just go to you guys and get all my old notes. Daniel chapter 2. This is right on the heels or right around their graduation time from their 3 years of training. By the way, if you're doing the math and say, wait a minute, Nebuchadnezzar's years in on the throne and their training, it seems part years count as full years in Middle Eastern thinking. All right, so don't think of, you know, they have two semesters per year and they've got to get through six semesters. It doesn't work quite that way. And the same thing's true with Nebuchadnezzar's reign. If I remember right, the Chaldeans had an inauguration year or a throne year. So the first year didn't count as their official year. The first full year ended up doing it. So he would have been on the throne for a little while before they started counting. So it works out. In the second year of the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar, now let me pause here for just a moment. Understand that you're not dealing with a novice who was coming to the throne. Nebuchadnezzar was the commander of the Babylonian armies for a number of years. His father was king. As crown prince, of course, he would have been taught and trained along the way as well. But he was leading the armies. He's the one that defeated the Assyrians and the Egyptians at Carchemish in northern Syria. That's a few years back. He's the one that did a lot of these things. He was the one leading the campaigns. He's the one that did all these things. And he was in the middle of all this. About the time, just before Daniel was deported, when he's on the field of battle and he finds out his father has died. So he has to drop everything, run back to Babylon, go through all the proceedings, you know, where they bring the crown and they put it on his head, the whole bit. He has to go back to Babylon to do all those things. There's a lull in things, but there's some overlap. It all fits together. But he's not a novice. He's a very smart fellow. Nebuchadnezzar is, even in secular history, is considered to be a great king and a very wise and astute ruler, although a guy with a temperament problem, and we'll see that in the next few chapters. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep break from him. The idea of his spirit troubled is he woke up, you know, wide awake, probably in a cold sweat, kind of one of those things, which for a guy with his brass was kind of a serious thing. His sleep departed. And the king commanded to call the magicians, astrologers, sorcerers, and Chaldeans. You can find out who each one of these folks are. I think there's a total of six scattered throughout the book of Daniel that make up these various things. We don't do this in our culture, but there's a lot of places around the world that still do. Why is it that rhinos are almost extinct? No, they're horns. We're talking about rhinos, all right? The horns are used for all kinds of things. Every part of a rhino, every part of a tiger is considered magical. And in Chinese medicine and so on, they use every last little bit of these things to turn into some sort of potion. Rhino horn in almost any form is more valuable than gold per ounce. There was a zoo someplace out east that for years made a ton of money selling rhino urine to the eastern markets, if you can believe that. They use it all kinds of things. That's an old idea. You know, Eye of Newt and this whole thing. And it was considered serious business. The people who peddled, if you're willing to pay that much for a little bit of rhino horn, or that much for, they take deer antlers while they're still in the velvet, and they use that. They use all kinds of things. They're sometimes poaching for gallbladders on bears here in the States because they're worth a fortune overseas. Weird stuff. And yet they're serious about this. They believe this stuff. They take classes on how this, you know, they do all this stuff. And the ancient Babylonians were the same way. That's basically the school that Daniel and his three friends went to, was to teach this stuff. Now, do they believe this stuff, Daniel and his friends? No, they've been taught the scriptures. they have been taught, and we'll find out later on, we'll get much further into the book, Daniel was familiar with the other prophets. Not just the law, but he was familiar with the other prophets. He had a copy of Jeremiah, which is remarkable because there's some overlap in those two fellows. So he would have known from Isaiah and other places, there's only one God. And all this other stuff is the creation of men. It's just wood, it's just stone, it's just bronze, it's just whatever it's made out of, but that's all it is. And so it's all fraudulent. But the people of those cultures, and even today, are really serious about this. And so he wants to find out what this is all about. This dream, I mean, it's vividly impressed into his mind. And we don't know what time. I would suggest that this is in the wee earlies of the morning. It's probably still dark outside. Got this dream. I got to find out what this is all about. I'm the king. I can find out right now. So he summons this long list of people who specialize in different things. Some of these things were remarkable. You know, we still have it today. Palm reading, reading tea leaves, tarot cards. Astrology, in ancient times, there's a couple of places where, it mentions, and I can't remember whether it's in Jeremiah or Ezekiel, I think it's in Ezekiel, where it talks about Nebuchadnezzar when he was invading this area before Daniel was deported, just before Daniel was deported. He comes to the crossroads. Is he gonna go to the left as he's heading south and go to the Ammonites and besiege Rabbah, the capital of the Ammonites, which is today's Ammon, same city? And conquer them, or is he going to go to the right and go down to Jerusalem and deal with them? Got to choose. I can't do both at the same time. So it says he looked in the arrows. He looked in the liver. They would throw arrows down, a handful of arrows on the ground. How they landed, like pickup sticks, and how they landed. They were special people, had years of training. Okay, this means, and they are going to go, and they're going to deal with which way they're pointing and all these other things. They would be able to deduce what we're supposed to do. Look in the liver. There's a sheep over here. Okay, bring that sheep over here. Kill the sheep. Gut it. Pull out the liver. Okay, let's read the liver. They have actually found models of livers and how to, with markings all over them and stuff. I think I dealt with this a number of years ago. You ever seen in a museum or maybe in a real old antique shop a phrenology model? You ever seen one of those? Feeling the bumps on your head? People read the bumps on your heads, phrenology. Okay, this is right in the same territory. All right. Used to be people did that. They'd come over and they do this, you know. Okay. All right.
Sample.
Yeah, you're the sample. Oh my. Oh. Ooh. Same thing with this. Same thing with all kinds of things. Trying to deduce the future, trying to deduce what cannot be understood by the senses. And he puts stock in this, at least has. Calls the guys, and they came and stood before the king, probably in an adjacent meeting hall. Dealt with this when we're dealing with the Persian kings. This is true for ancient monarchs across the board. You don't allow easy access to yourself. If I wanted to have a chat with the President of the United States, I'm not going to have easy access. Odds are I'm not going to be able to talk to him. I have to have a really good reason to talk to him. National security, you have to have something that he wants from me rather than I want from him. In little teeny tiny nations, monarchs, rulers, vice presidents, presidents, prime ministers, and so on are a little more accessible. You know, if I wanted to talk to the crown prince of the country of Liechtenstein, go to Vaduz. There are more people in Puyallup than there are in Liechtenstein. I could probably make arrangements to talk to the Prince of Liechtenstein. You know, just, but it's also a safety issue. It isn't just time, it's safety. A lot of these guys died of assassination. Nebuchadnezzar's son is gonna die of assassination. The guy who bumps off Nebuchadnezzar's son to take his place, either he or his son, I can't remember which, also got bumped off, and then somebody else came in. And so it's a risky business. So he's going to call for the wise men. They're going to meet probably in some sort of an adjacent hall. and they have gathered together. So figure between in verse 2, there's a little gap of time. Now these guys, they're being summoned by the king. They're going to get ready as quick as they can. They jump out of bed, jump into their robes, get on all their turbans and all their stuff, make sure they look official, off down as quick as they possibly can. So they came and stood before the king, end of verse 3. And the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream. How many of you, when you read the scriptures, especially when you're back in the second half of Exodus, you're in Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, the repetition gets a little tedious. And I was talking to one of you this morning, talking about the repetition, and it's just, yeah, all right, it's a cultural thing. You got to go through the whole story. You got to do it again. You got to do it again. You got to do it again. Especially in cultures where the majority of the people did not read, you want to rehearse these things so that the thought, the idea, the storyline is embedded in the brain. All right. I alluded to Job this morning in the Sunday school hour. Job was probably, we don't know this for certain, but Job was very likely an oral tradition for centuries before somebody actually bothered writing it all down. And it's kind of interesting. They have determined that a lot of cultures, these things that are passed on from generation to generation, if somebody, some traveler, wrote this stuff down 150 years ago, 200 years ago, and they compare it with the tradition that is still being repeated, it's exactly the same. They memorize these things word perfect. So repetition is an important part of this thing. So dreaming a dream. And he dreamed a dream. And my spirit was troubled. My spirit hit me, is the idea there, to know the dream. Now, the word there, know, is only used in conjunction with interpreting dreams. But in this context, it's also going to be stretched a little bit, as we'll see. Verse 4, then spake the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans is also a word that is used sometimes ethnically. Nebuchadnezzar himself was a Chaldean. Talked a little bit about the Chaldeans last time. I went and double-checked, and it was indeed the Chaldeans that ran off with Job's camels. All right, they're an old tribe, been around for a long time. They're sort of a subset of the Aramaeans, and they moved down into Babylon and actually gained ascendancy and ruled the country for a while, Nebuchadnezzar being the chief one. So the Chaldeans are an ethnic group, but in this particular case, it's a sect of priests, most likely those who were the priests of Marduk or Bel, the chief god of Babylon. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac. All right. If somebody has a new translation, do you have something there besides Syriac? Aramaic. Aramaic. The book of Daniel, from that point on, through the end of chapter 7, is written in Aramaic. And I think we dealt with this a couple of weeks ago when we were dealing with the introduction. The book of Daniel is written in two languages. Aramaic is used for one verse in Jeremiah and most of a chapter in Ezra. In both of those places, they are quoting something, a letter that was sent to the king of Persia in Ezra. And he said, and the letter was thus, and he gives it to us, not in Hebrew, but he gives it to us in the original, which would have been Aramaic. What's the significance? Aramaic, by the way, is still spoken by several hundred thousand people today in parts of Syria and other sections of that part of the Middle East, a little bit of northern Iraq, but mostly in Syria. At least it used to be before the current issues are going to come up. They use the same alphabet as Hebrew. It's a very similar language to Hebrew. It's an old language. We're familiar as archaeologists, they're familiar with documents that are from almost 1,000 BC or more, written in Aramaic. And like I said, it's still used today. From, probably well over 1,000 years. If you had a message, you're the king of Egypt, you're the pharaoh of Egypt, and you want to send a message to the king of Babylon, or you want to send a message to the Hittites, or you want to send a message to Mitanni, or you want to send a message to the Assyrians, or you want to send a message to some other kingdom in that region. You didn't send it an Egyptian. Nobody knew Egyptian except Egyptians, hardly. What about Hittite? They still haven't figured out Hittite today. They got all kinds of documents written in Hittite. They still haven't deciphered Hittite. All right. What language do you use for international communications or international commerce in the ancient Near East? Aramaic. Aramaic was known and understood by most of the folks there. When the Assyrians invaded and the fella came out and he's speaking to the people on the wall during the siege when Hezekiah, was inside. This is just before God killed all those Assyrian soldiers and delivered them. But the guy's out there speaking to them in Hebrew. And the ministers of Hezekiah say, speak to your people, speak to us in Assyrian, or in Aramaic, because we know the language. Don't speak to it in Hebrew. He says, no, I'm going to speak in Hebrew so all these people can understand what I'm saying. The diplomats knew Aramaic. So it was the language of commerce, it was the language of diplomacy in the day. And the folks there in Babylon would have spoken at least a dialect of Aramaic as their main language. So starting there in verse 4 through the end of chapter 7, we are dealing with Daniel written in Aramaic. Now, is there significance to this? Talked about this a little bit 2 weeks ago. Daniel is in three sections language-wise. We start out with Hebrew, we shift to Aramaic, and then we come back to Hebrew. It's very interesting that the sections written in Hebrew deal with Israel and Israelites, and the sections dealing in written in Aramaic deal with the Gentile nations. All right, it's that way, I think, by design. You have a theme that recurs in the Aramaic section. The idea of peoples, languages, and so people's languages, and I'm trying to remember what the other word was, but people, languages, and tongues, nations. All right, that is a prominent theme. It's repeated a number of different times in that section that's written in Aramaic. The focus on the Hebrew sections is dealing with the Hebrew, the Jewish people. The focus of the sections dealing in written in Aramaic are with the Gentile nations of the world. So, with that, we're jumping into a section that deals with the Gentile nations. We have these charlatan soothsayers and so forth come in, and the king asks them to know the dream. Now, he deals with a general request there in verse 3. And so they come in and they flatter the king and they do all their stuff and they say, oh, king, live forever. Long live the king. Tell thy servants the dream and we will show the interpretation. Now, they even have this in some of the cuneiform tablets that they have discovered in different parts of the Middle East. I'm not kidding when I said these guys went to school for 3 years to learn all this nonsense. They had an extensive mythology and methodology on how to interpret all these different things. And since Daniel, and it was not, we do this in the States. Most places around the world do not do this. Religion and governance and daily living and everything were all wrapped up in one and are still in most places. The United States, they've, since the early 60s and so on, they've tried to cut and dice it and divide it all up. Most places around the world, ancient times, certainly, it's all one thing. If the king is going to know how to rule, he has to be able to discern the spirits because they control things. Or at least they have some influence. Understand the idea of an omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent God in paganism doesn't exist. The gods were limited to certain realms and so on. They did not have unrestricted power. If I was dealing with one particular area, I have a god who deals with rain. But that god who deals with rain may have nothing to do with earthquakes. So if I'm dealing with an earthquake situation, then I got to talk to the earthquake god. You know, it's like going to a big company. Oh, I have to talk. I'm sorry, that's the wrong department. Let me send you to such and such. All right. We deal with the God who is in control of everything. We have an omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient God. Pagan gods in the minds, of course they don't exist, but in the minds of their creators and worshipers were limited. And so they had different spheres and so on. And so he says, show us the dream, we'll show the interpretation. You tell us what it is, we'll figure it out. If we don't, I've got my manual here and I'll be able to flip through there and we'll get this thing taken care of. Nebuchadnezzar is an astute guy. He's an observer. He has an attitude that reflects a more modern way of thinking. Not necessarily better, although there's certain aspects of it that are better. He has an empirical mindset, which means I want to see it. I'm not just going to just accept that you guys can do this. I want you to prove it to me. You prove to me that you can actually do the things you're claiming to do. I mean, for all I know, you're making this all up. Now, what he is demanding here was a, as the fellows will say, is a rare thing. They say, tell us the dream. We'll show you the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. He's not saying, oh, I've forgotten the dream. That's not what he's saying. That can be deduced from how the King James has phrased it, but that isn't what he's saying. New translation. What has somebody got? The thing is gone from me.
The word for me is firm.
Basically, I said what I said. I said, I want you to tell me the dream and the interpretation. I asked you to tell me the interpretation. I'm not telling you anything more. You guys are the geniuses as far as this stuff is concerned. You guys are supposedly tapped into the supernatural realm. You should be able to get this thing figured out. You should be able to know the dream and the interpretation. So get with it. What I said is what I said. Now, does Nebuchadnezzar want to know about the dream? Yes, I think he does. But he's going to use this as an opportunity because it's so vividly implanted in his mind that he knows exactly how the dream was, and he's going to be able to tell whether these guys have even a clue as to what he dreamed and what he's asking for. The king said, the thing is gone from me. If he will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof, so he presumes that they can't. Which is why he's probably sprung this on them in the first place, because he's thinking these guys, I've been taken for a ride for a long time, and my father was taken for a ride for a long time, and his father before him, and his father before him. We've been dealing with charlatans for generations, and I don't think these guys are the real deal. So if you can't do this, oh man, these guys are in deep trouble. End of verse 5. Ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. The Babylonians were only about one step behind the Assyrians as far as ruthlessness and nastiness as far as how they dealt with people. I mean, you know, when you kill somebody, they're dead. You can't do anything more than kill them. Well, I suppose you can shame them and try to do all these other nasty things, but the person who's dead doesn't know or care at that point. But they can certainly make the process as unpleasant as possible. And so they would do the same thing, frankly, that the English did during the Middle Ages and even beyond a little bit. They'd do things like drawing and quartering and all these other nasty things. And when it says you'll be cut in pieces, they wouldn't cut you in half or cut your head off and then cut up the body. They'd start with the extremities and work their way in. It's just a very, very unpleasant thing. So we're dealing with not just death. We're dealing with a very unpleasant and painful process that may take hours and hours. And it's just, all right. And your house made a dunghill. The word dunghill can mean literally a dunghill. It is also translated at least one place in the book of Ezra as just ruin. That it's over and done with. Your house, by the way, is not necessarily the building you live in, but also your family, your legacy. So I'm going to make you die a painful, lingering death, and your legacy is shot. I'm going to destroy everything that's important to you. Because you have risen to a place of prominence by fraud and deceit. But that was the bad news. Here's the good news. Verse 6. If you show me the dream and the interpretation thereof, ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. I'm going to give you all that you could possibly dream of. Where you are right now, you are going to arrive at the pinnacle of your dreams and aspirations. but you got to show me the dream and the interpretation. There's not a third choice. Verse 7. They answered again. You got this big group of guys that are trying to be polite, but they're beginning to sweat. They answered again and said, let the king tell, they're probably speaking a little more slowly, let the king tell his servants the dream and we will show the interpretation of it. They go back to their original request, which is probably a line they have memorized because every time they're summoned, they probably ask the same thing. All right? You want a dream interpreted? Tell us the dream, we'll tell you the interpretation. That's what they said when they came in. He gives them the spiel there for the couple of verses, and they say, all right, we're going to pretend we didn't hear that. You just tell us the dream, and we'll tell you the interpretation. We'll try not to be shaken up. We'll figure you just misspoke. And the king answered, verse 8, and said, I know for of certainty that you would gain the time. It is actually in the original, by time, by the time. It's exactly how we would say it today. You're trying to buy time. I know of a certainty that you would gain the time because you see the thing is gone from me. I said what I said. You recognize that and you're trying to dodge and skirt the issue. But I said what I said. You tell me the dream and the interpretation. Now, let's look at this from our perspective as Bible believers who understand there's only one true God and so forth. Nebuchadnezzar is being empirical. I want evidence that you guys are the real deal. The other fellows, though, think about this. They could make up whatever they wanted to make up. They could make it out for a long way away, long distance away, long time away, and no one would ever know the difference. Or they could do what was often the case. We see it in today's, what are they called? Almost said obituaries. That's not the word I'm looking for. Your horoscope. Or your fortune in the fortune cookie. They're often vague. You ever notice that? Matter of fact, the vast majority of the time, they're vague, other than on the flip side where it says learn Chinese. Right? They're very vague, usually. And they don't necessarily, some of them give a timetable, some of them don't, but they're vague, and if you're looking for a fulfillment, you can say, people who actually, oh, here's the fulfillment! Yeah, it's not necessarily as grand as they were intimating, but that's okay. I got my interpretation, I got my fulfillment, therefore it's true. You're looking for a fulfillment. They would keep it vague, they would keep, so the python at the oracle at Delphi would give proclamations that were so vague that if they won the battle, it was fulfilled, and if they lost the battle, it was fulfilled in the same. You know, great at parallel meanings and all these other things. And they had these things all laid out so that you could always say, Your Majesty, see, it did happen exactly as we said. And then they would give the doublespeak to make it happen. But he's not going to go for that. He's asking for them something that they cannot do by being con men. He says in verse 9, and he's very astute, and he makes it fairly brief here. But if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you, and he's the one that issues the decrees, that ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me. Till the time be changed, you're going to keep putting it off. You're going to keep trying to be deceptive and so on to gain some time. Maybe even try to bump off the king so this thing can all stop, get somebody else in there that'd be more friendly to us. Therefore, he says, tell me the dream and I shall make known and you shall show me that the interpretation thereof. Do this. Fulfill my request. Well, now these guys know that they're backed up against the wall. So now that they can say what they're actually thinking. Verse 10. The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, lord, or ruler that asks such things of any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. It is a rare thing that the king requireth. And there is none other than that can show it before the king, except the gods whose dwelling is not in flesh. You are asking something that is humanly impossible to fulfill. Now, they actually tripped themselves there in verse 11. There is none other than the God that can show it except the gods. These guys were supposed to have contact with the spirit world. They were supposed to be able to tap into, they're priests. What is a priest by definition? It isn't just a guy with a backward collar. What's a priest? By definition.
The one who speaks to the God.
The one who speaks to the God. Who communes to the God. He goes in, talks to the God, comes out, tells the people what the God said. He's the one that has direct access, which is why believers are priests. Every believer is a priest because we now have direct access to God. Jesus Christ is our great high priest who opened the way. All of us have access. That's why the veil was torn. All right, somebody who has direct access to God. These are people who are supposed to have access to deity. They have made proclamations and so on. Marduk says this. Bel says this. Ashtoreth says this. They go through all the deities that they represent, and they're supposed to be the spokesman for these various deities. They have access, supposedly, to the spirit world. And they're saying, well, nobody knows this except the gods. Well, don't you talk to them? Don't you have regular access? I mean, this is your job. You're supposed to have regular access. You talk to these. Supposedly, they talk to you, too. So, you know, talk to your God, and he should be able to, they say it can't be done. Which, again, betrays the fact that they are indeed frauds. They can't do what they have in the past claimed to be able to do. In verse 12, for this cause the king was angry and very furious. Okay, we could translate this into English. He blew a gasket, okay? He went absolutely bonkers with rage. He'll do that again in chapter 3, by the way. He was angry. Now, these guys know that they're toast anyway. So might as well speak the truth and see what you can, if the king will back down. For this cause, the king was very angry, very fierce, and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. All of them. Now, the fellows who came there were probably just representative. They were the top guys. I mean, if they're training the likes of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel to do this, there must have been maybe several hundred, maybe even 1,000 of these guys, doing these things. The guys who are top notch in their trade, training the younger guys to fill their role, an endless succession of wise men. And so, the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. The guys that were dealing with the dialogue here are probably already toast. They're right there. Nebuchadnezzar has a bunch of armed guards and so on around him. He summons the captain of his executioners, who, by the way, is one of the guys who was right there, probably. And they grab these guys, and we don't want to mess up the hall here. We're going to take them outside and do this. But those guys were probably dispatched right off the bat. And so we got to round up the rest of these guys. Now remember, it's probably still dark. We're dealing with the wee earlies in the morning, probably. And so we got to round up these guys. We don't necessarily have a list of where they all, but kind of interesting that if you were to keep written records, these are also the guys, for the most part, who could read and write the written records. So tracking down these guys is a matter of hit or miss or somebody knowing something. So it's going to take a little while to fulfill the king's command. They're not all, you know, living in the same barracks or something. And they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. They are among them. They're newbies. These guys are still in their late teens, probably. They are newbies. They were not part of this. Doesn't make any difference. They have been trained to be professional liars. And I'm not going to have any of this. They're going to go too. All of them are going to go. All the trainees, everybody, we're going to just do away with this whole thing and do something else. Then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom unto Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, the king's executioners, which had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. Now understand, these guys are probably being rounded up and then taken to a place of a mass execution. We're making an example of them. It's going to be a public statement and so forth. Public executions were standard part of the course for most of human history. And so Daniel, and this guy's just doing his job. He's not necessarily, he hasn't, you know, blown a gasket like Nebuchadnezzar has. He's doing his job. And so Daniel, it says, answered the, and said, why is the decree, this, Daniel is a very, my wife and I have a friend who lives in another state, who could walk up to you and say, you know, you're the ugliest, stupidest guy I've ever met in my life. And you would say, well, thank you. He's just that way. He can tell you anything you want, and you never take it as offense. He smile at you while he says it. He's in public office, by the way. fits great for that kind of thing. But he has this gift, and you've known him. She's known him since he was a kid. He's always been this way. Daniel seems to have this gift. He can come in. He's not necessarily insulting Arioch or anything, but he can approach somebody and just all of a sudden the temper and everything is off, and he can just carry on a nice conversation with the guy who's come to kill him and says, so tell me, why are you in such a hurry? What's this thing all about? And the guy tells him. Now, this, I think, is an indication of divine intervention. All right? Divine intervention. God has worked in this guy, in Arioch, so that he would be receptive to Daniel. Maybe they knew each other from, you know, somewhere along the way. Maybe Daniel's just one of these guys that knows everybody, remembers everybody's name, you know. Every time he sees him, asks how his wife and the kids are, and knows the name of the wife and the kids. You know, just keep it personal. But whatever the case may be, he asks Arioch, and Arioch is helpful. Arioch made known to Daniel what the whole situation was there at the end of verse 15. Then Daniel went in. Okay, between verses 15 and 16, you probably have a little block of time. Not necessarily days or anything, but probably a little window of time. Because remember, nobody has direct access to the king. Or he has just a few people, 3, 4, 5 people. They have direct access to him. And so if somebody is going to go to the king, they have to go through several hoops to get there. Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time. Same thing the other guys have asked for, but he says he would show the king the interpretation. I will fulfill your request, but I need a little bit of time. Now, did Daniel go in and tell Nebuchadnezzar face to face? We don't know. It's possible. We don't know. But he evidently, from what we're able to deduce from verses 15 through 17, he got his request. I suspect that after half hour, 45 minutes, or even a couple of hours, Nebuchadnezzar has cooled down enough to be rational. He still was serious in what he said. But he's willing to be wise and diligent and careful about it. He's still going to pull it off, but he's not going to allow his passions to overrule his reason. Daniel goes to his house. Little split-level place. And made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions. What he probably went to is back to the dormitory or whatever it was. And these four guys roomed together. I think that's fairly clear here. Also, what would be another reason why they would be rooming together? Several reasons, I think.
Keep their separation.
All right, they're Jews. Camaraderie of being able to speak Hebrew when they're at home. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. There we go. It would be convenient for Ashpenaz to just bring one, have the servants deliver one great big huge room service platter to these guys instead of having to hunt around the dormitory and give them each four. Alright, one here, one here, one here, one here. Alright, instead these guys are all roomed together. Here's your dinner. Here's your lunch. Here's your breakfast. Whatever it might be.
So they were probably rooming together. Practically speaking, the Babylonians would have done this. On their request, they would probably have done it as well. He makes known to the thing to his companions. All right, here's what's going on, and here's what I told the king. And then they decide they're going to have a prayer meeting. That they would desire the mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, and that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. The commentators were on both sides of this. I suspect that the reprieve was only for these four. Because of that one line, that they would not perish with the rest of them. The reprieve, at least initially, I think is only for the four. The execution is still going on as they find these guys and round them up. Now, this doesn't mean that they are being slaughtered on sight as soon as they are captured, but I think the guys are being rounded up and the process is beginning. But these guys, they get their stay of execution. So these guys have a prayer meeting. I suspect that there's some urgency with this prayer meeting. I suspect that they didn't say, I'll tell you what, it's awful. We've had a long day and we'll pray in the morning. I think they probably, prayed until they fell asleep. Anybody here been involved in an all night prayer meeting? Alright. I've been involved in some attempted all night prayer meetings. I think I've shared with you, Brother Holmshire was notorious for being able to get by on like 4 hours of sleep or something like that, and he kind of assumed the rest of us could do the same. All right, boys, we're going to pray all night. And he'd be praying, and Brother Holmshire could pray for probably 3 or 4 hours on end without stopping. All right, have Brother Larry pray. Larry, pray. Okay, and then Larry prays for a little while. All right. Have so-and-so pray. Boss, he's asleep. Wake him up! I think with the urgency of this situation, I think these guys are intercessing for themselves and praying earnestly. But here's something interesting. You get into this, I don't think it was an all-night prayer meeting. Verse 19, then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Now, doesn't that say in a dream? Could have happened while he was praying, but they may have actually gone to sleep. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. I got the answer. I got the answer. He blessed the God of heaven. By the way, I meant to look this up. I didn't do it. The figure of speech, or the expression God of heaven, is seldom or never used chronologically before the captivity. I wanted to make sure that it was a never. Dave, you want to check that out? Look up God of heaven and find out if it's used prior to the captivity. Why do you suppose that when we start dealing with the captivity, we see this expression?
Probably because most of the other gods are material. They're, found here on earth.
Okay, that's true. I think that might be part of it, to differentiate the God they worship from the gods that are around them, who are gods of the rivers, gods of the trees, gods of the mountains, God of the rain, God of the clouds, God of whatever. All right, why else? By the way, how big is heaven?
They're out of the land.
I'm not going to say he's the God of Israel, because that is going to, at least in the mind of some, limit him to a piece of real estate. But God, our God that we are worshiping, and we're not in that piece of real estate. We're still worshiping this God, and this God is here, and he's with us because he is the God of heaven. He is not just the God of Israel. He is not limited to a piece of real estate. He is the God of heaven. Blessed be the name of the Lord forever and ever. For wisdom and might are his. We have this little psalm by Daniel. He changeth the time. Yeah, see, here he's going to weave in the interpretation a little bit in his
his psalm here. He says, he changeth times and seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He is making a declaration of basically, excuse me, the theme for the rest of the book of Daniel. Because a reference to God in the book of Daniel is not just the God of heaven, but something that is frequent in the book of Daniel. Is the Most High God. You got all these other gods who are not gods. I worship the Most High, the highest God, the Supreme God. And he's in control of the affairs of men. He sets up kings and removes kings. Even, don't want to say this, get yourself in political trouble, Nebuchadnezzar. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that show understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things, the thing that we have just been requesting of him. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. If I'm going to find out what's in the dark, then I need some light. Yes, Dave?
God of heaven, right?
Yep.
Shows up in Ezra and Nehemiah.
Okay, only post-exilic. It's only after that, Ezra and Nehemiah, as well as here. And so that, even though they were back in the land in Ezra and Nehemiah for the most part, it's after the exile. God is not limited to this piece of turf.
One time in Genesis.
Which is before they were in the turf and it didn't matter. And then he gives thanks. In verse 23, I give thanks and praise thee, O God of my fathers, and has given me wisdom and might, and has made known unto me now what. Look at that. We, so he brings his companions into this as far as what they were, it was revealed to Daniel, but they all desired it, for thou hast made known unto us, all four of us, the king's matter. All four of them were involved. But the vision was given to Daniel. Therefore Daniel went, we got the answer, we got what we were looking for, he doesn't delay, he goes straight to Arioch, and we'll pick it up there next time. Okay, any questions or additional thoughts or ideas here? All right, let's pray. Father, thank you that you are the same God who does the same things that you did in that day. You set up kings and you take down kings. You rule the nations. You rule the world. You are the God of heaven. And Father, may we recognize that your power has not decreased over time. You are omnipotent and you are omniscient. Nothing is caught. Nothing catches you by surprise. You have not lost control because of circumstances or anything else. Father, you are very much in control. Father, thank you that you are indeed our Father. And what a wonderful thing it is to have a Father who is in control. Father, may we recognize that. Give us peace of mind as we live in a reckless, wild world. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.